It's another Sunday afternoon here in the Paris of the South, as my friend Francois calls it. And it's time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me today in the studio, Mimi White, who is a New Hampshire poet who happened to be down here on vacation. And we gave a reading together at Malaprops, and her work was really fantastic. So I thought, what better way to celebrate her being here in the South than to put her on the radio and put her on the spot. Welcome to Wordplay, Mimi.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what brought you to Asheville?
An astrologer. Well, we decided that we would have a reading, my husband and I, and in the course of the reading, she said, what do you want? And I said, I just want to leave. So she said, go somewhere. So we chose Asheville because we're from New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And this
good
is
time
a lot
to get away
yeah.
from.
Oh, there's still snow, apparently, in our yard.
I'm sure.
We have reports. And no reports of anything flowering, not even little tiny green sprouts coming up. Yeah. So we just got online. I found a rental property on Cumberland Alley. Kind of checked out that that was within walking distance to downtown.
Right.
Where I live, I can walk to the ocean. I can walk to the post office, the library. So it's a different city. It's a town, small town of 5,000. So we just came here and hoped that we would escape the last part of winter and get spring.
Yeah. You certainly got some spring.
We did. I mean, we got snow the second day we got here, but A, we had snow tires. So that was good.
Yeah.
B, they got a foot back home. So we already felt we were ahead of the game.
Yeah. Right. Plus you get flowers and things like that.
Oh, I know. I said to my husband, boy, this has been everything we thought it would be. How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
How did it all sort of fall into place?
Yeah.
And then to have an opportunity to read with you and to read with Sebastian.
Yeah,
and
that was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
And to fall into a community of like-minded people. That's always a surprise.
Yeah. Did you know Sebastian prior to coming here?
I did. I am very close with his mom.
Oh, yeah.
Marie.
Right. Marie.
Yeah. Who is also Marie Harris, who's also a Scorpio, by the way.
Right, I know.
Oh, you do know that?
As was Bill.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sebastian's dad.
Yeah. I didn't know that. This is a little November
little fact,
birthday
little
thing going right. on here for those of you who aren't born in that month. But I did know him. Actually, I saw him in the summers at Skim Milk Farm, which is one of the places that we would retire to once a week. Gene Pedrick owned this wonderful farm in Brentwood, New Hampshire, and once a week poets got together and read their poems under the trees and then had a huge feast for late lunch.
Fabulous.
And Sebastian came to that when he was a wee boy.
Yeah. Sebastian and I met him, though, in 1968, I believe it was, when I think he was three.
It's a while back.
Went to meet him again. It was quite a shock to see him, all grown up with, graying hair.
Early.
Oh, well.
But because his mother's my friend, and he's not that much younger than I am, but still, he seems to be of a different generation.
Yes, yeah.
So we were happy that he was here because we knew there was someone. We didn't need somebody, but it has been wonderful to have his friendship.
Right. He's a very generous and wonderful person.
Yeah.
Longtime co-host here, actually, on Wordplay.
Yeah, that's what you told
me.
Right,
yeah. Well, how did you come into writing?
I started writing stories when I was a little kid. I'm the youngest of four.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the youngest in the family, you know that they're in charge of you.
Uh-huh.
They sort of run the show.
Yeah.
So when I could start to write, I was probably seven, I started writing stories because I really liked the opportunity to be in control of plot. I mean, I didn't know it was plot, and I didn't know it was character. I just thought there were these people, and I was making a story, and I could do anything I wanted to. There's a tremendous amount of freedom. So for a long time, I thought I'd be a story writer.
Yeah.
And but then along the way, I thought I'd be a zoologist, and that didn't pan out. And so I did what most people do when they're in college and they don't know what they're going to do.
You became an English major.
Exactly. It was one language that I was speaking and I knew. So I went to a land-grant school, so I learned a lot of sciences, which I really love.
Uh-huh.
But fell in love with the way in which language reveals what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. That, to me, became important. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really turn to writing seriously till after we had our first child.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I married young, we had our kids young, and after Rachel was born, Steve and I were in Connecticut for a while, and I got a babysitter, and I just went to the library and started writing. And then when I got home, I looked to see what was happening at UNH, University of New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and Charles Simic had just arrived.
Oh, yeah.
And I started to take special classes and started to write more, and eventually I enrolled in their graduate writing program. Mm-hmm. But it was a little later in life. I was a little older than the other students, yeah. Yeah. And I was happy to have had those experiences. Yeah. Yeah,
there were advantages.
Yeah. To having a life that grounded me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. And then I studied with other people there, but that was the beginning.
Plus, gave you lots of other occasions to write about then, or to write from.
It gave me a lot to write about. Yeah. Although at that point in my life, I was writing a lot about death. Not that a lot had happened, but I was looking at the dark side.
Right.
It still has a vein in my work, because I do think that there is the light and the dark that go together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at that point, I didn't know how to balance them, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And you're dealing probably with so much with the light in your life, mm-hmm. that the imagination had to grapple with the dark side as well.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Was Simic a good teacher? I mean, did you enjoy...
Simic is an unusual teacher.
Is he?
Yes. Well, he's an incredibly funny man. Mm-hmm. He teaches anecdotally.
Oh.
I don't know if he ever... I know he had a syllabus because we used to get them, but in workshop we didn't. And he'd just say... The beauty of this is you just write a poem a week and then we talk about it. You know, he knew how to simplify things. When you read a poem, he would never start with looking at it critically.
Yeah.
He would tell a story.
Uh-huh.
And from the story, you would realize that, I started in the wrong place. none of this really matters but that over there. Uh-huh. So the stories were almost metaphors for gleaning the information. And then he would say, that doesn't work. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
And when something did work, he was astonished at it, but spent little time with it.
Uh-huh. That works. not necessary to spend time with that.
Exactly. but he was not the most generous, but he was incredibly brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And perceptive.
Very, very perceptive. Yeah. Busy running his own life and has a really kind heart. Mm-hmm. When you have an opportunity to see him, I'd seen him recently in Portsmouth. He'd read and he started reminiscing about how long we had known each other, which for now is more than 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it surprised me that he had all these memories of our acquaintance and our friendship. Mm-hmm. Because he is busy with his life. And he's a private person.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. He was a poet laureate for a year or so back.
Yeah, right.
And Steve asked me, what did I think of that? I said, I think it must have been hard for him.
Yeah,
it's not something that he would take to.
Not given to public roles in that way.
But a very political person one of the things I love about his work is that he reminds you that it's important to say what's happening in the world. I mean, he grew up in war-torn, Yugoslavia.
Right.
And then fled. He was a refugee. So he knows that.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing to bring to poetry for us.
Sure. Right. Since otherwise, American poetry tends to be somewhat detached from that political world.
Yeah. And his poems are really these wonderful little parables that reveal precisely with humor. He's very, very funny. He said he always wanted to be the onion that made you laugh. So I, of course, was intimidated.
Yeah, of course.
I was still young enough to know that this was the real deal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So who besides Simic do you count as your, as people whose work you've modeled your own on? Or
well, with Simic, I really didn't model. Mm-hmm. I took in what he said, and then I sort of moved away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, when I was still at the University of Massachusetts and discovering that I would major in English instead of zoology and have to give up the lab coat, which I was disappointed about.
Well, you can keep your lab coat.
You can keep your lab coat, but you better not do anything important with instruments.
I met
Ann Sexton. She came and read, and as it turned out, lived in Newton, where I grew up, and my mother sold her Woolbrook Encyclopedia. My mother sold encyclopedias door to door.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah.
That's how Woolbrook was distributed.
My mother.
Yeah.
Personally, the whole nation. She was actually really good at it, and they wanted to move her to Chicago, but that didn't work out with four kids and a husband in Massachusetts.
Right.
But my mother told me about her, and she became sort of mythological to me. And I had been reading, of course, everything from 17th century to modern poetry when I was studying, and
as an English major. Right.
And her voice came along, and I thought, oh my gosh, you can write about your uterus if you want.
Right.
You can write about jelly jars, your legs. I mean, she gave me a lot of permission to see myself as a woman who wrote poetry.
Right.
And I mean, I wouldn't want to go down the path she went down, which was very tragic.
Yeah.
Her ability, though, and her strong desire to put herself on the page as a confessional poet, as a woman, gave me a ton of permission, not to write like her, but to write.
Yeah.
So that was really important. And then in graduate school, I also worked with Carol Muskie. And
I don't know Carol Muskie's work, I don't think.
Well, Carol Muskie is a very female poet.
Mm-hmm.
She was working at that time with a lot with women in prison, and she brought their stories to the page. And she would say to me, "You don't seem to be a feminist poet, but everything you write seems to grow out of being female." You know, but by then I had had a couple of kids, and so my life was very female.
Right, right.
Carol taught me discipline. I mean, she was very disciplined. And then I worked with McKeel McBride, and McKeel was all about possibility.
Uh-huh.
I mean, McKeel looks at the whole universe and is a very spiritual, inspiring teacher.
Hmm.
And so the three of them were the teachers that I worked with at university. But when I was done, I just went in search of my own, you know, poets. And I ended up finding Stanley Kunitz. That's the poet that taught me that you become a person. He used to say, first you create the person who writes the poems. And then his little addendum is, and then you keep transforming yourself.
Because
that's what he did. You know, he said, I'm not done with my transformation.
He kept right on moving,
and he kept clarifying, and he kept burning away the useless words.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived his life, and he planted his garden, and he had compassion. And, of course, he was a moral compass, I think, for a lot of us in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really Stanley who I used as a model for being human.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rest fell into place.
Balancing the humanity with the poetry.
Yes.
In some sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
He would say, you can't put, a poem will resist being a political machine, but you need to be highly political as a person.
Yeah.
You need to be aware. So that's sort of a small history.
Yeah,
there are plenty of poets in between.
Right, right. Of course, right. We all read.
But those little.
A lot.
Yeah. Those were good highlights.
Yeah, well, those are good ones.
Mm.
And you're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio today, New Hampshire poet Mimi White. So, Mimi, when did you start publishing your work?
Let's see. I really didn't keep track. I started writing when I was 25.
Uh-huh. Seriously.
I dedicated myself. I said, I am going to be a poet. By mm-hmm. then, I'd had a kid. And that meant that I would carve time out of my day to write. That's what it meant to me. Mm-hmm. And learn as much as I could and read as much as I could. And then I did take classes and eventually enrolled in graduate school. I probably started publishing poems in magazines shortly thereafter, maybe by the time I was 28 or 30. And I was exuberant with, the first publications. And then shortly thereafter, maybe a year or two after that, I put together a manuscript. I think it was called Under the Dome Sky or Placing a Claim, something like that. I have them in the barn. And sent it out to five places, and it was a finalist at every place. And I thought,
cool.
Yeah, cool. This isn't so bad. Well, let's see. 30 years later, my full-length book came out, and 10 years earlier than that, a chapbook award.
Yeah.
So publication after about 10 or 15 years meant less and less.
Right.
I always wanted people to read my work.
Sure.
I was shocked when people did read my work mm-hmm. because I, for so long, thought I was writing in the dark.
Right.
But my friend Hildy Krill, who lives in Sweden now, who reads everything I write, says, oh, your work really grew when you were writing in the dark.
Uh-huh.
Best to not be known.
Yeah.
Because you eventually write into the voice that you're supposed to write.
Right.
Which is what Kay Ryan said last night on the News Hour, our current poet laureate. She said, you have to sort of be your own particular voice,
right.
And somehow you have to figure that out. So writing in the dark helped a lot.
Yeah, sure.
It didn't feel good.
Right. Feels sometimes very lonely.
It's very lonely. Right, That's why you need other people who write, and you need a spouse who says, keep writing. That helps.
Yeah. Right.
And to ignore the other comments. all the other comments.
Yeah. Well, let's. Why don't you read some poems for us?
I'll read from the book, The Last Island, which I understand there are a couple of copies still left at Malaprops.
That's right.
So if you haven't, or you want to pick it up, if you haven't picked it up,
it is still available.
It is still available.
And that's published by
Deerbrook Editions.
Yeah. It's a lovely book, by the way.
Cumberland, Maine. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You did a nice job, not only with the cover, but with the typesetting, and the whole thing looks very nice.
I have to credit Sharon Beals. She did the cover photograph, and it's a bird's nest. I think it's a finch. And I came across her work in Audubon and emailed her and Googled her, and she said, sure, you can have one. She was very, very generous.
Yeah.
Her work is online. You can find it, Sharon Beals. It's beautiful.
Great.
I think I'll read, the first one I'll read to you is called I'll Build You a House.
Okay.
And this grew out of the Portsmouth Poet Laureate Project. Portsmouth is a brilliant old seaside city near where I live. Uh-huh. And they have a poet laureate. Every two years they choose a new poet laureate. Yeah. They've been doing that for over 10 years, and I was the poet laureate of Portsmouth from 2005 to 2007. Your only responsibility is to create a project that creates community through poetry.
Well,
that's
great.
It. So I created a project that was very large. I won't go into it, but it's called What is Home?
Uh-huh.
And I chose that because I've never really known what it felt like to be totally at home.
Uh-huh.
When I first moved to New Hampshire, I'm very liberal. The state of New Hampshire has moved in my direction, I'm happy to say.
Good work.
We've worked hard. Being the outsider as a poet has helped.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also Jewish, and I felt that I had landed somehow in the land of Oz.
Oh, right.
And a
bunch of Yankees up there.
It's a bunch of Yankees. There aren't as many churches as you have, but eventually I just sort of, figured out my home was the fact that I live near the sea and I walk to the harbor every day. And mm-hmm. someone said, what do you do? I said, I'm the person who walks to the harbor every day, mm-hmm. usually with a dog. And in the course of doing this, we had five poets around the city teach classes free. So we taught over 60 people, and then we had a satellite project in Sweden. So my friend who lives at Hildi Krill ran a group, and we had a lot of people from other countries there, and Hildi translated their work. And it all ended up in a wonderful book called What is Home? Uh-huh. And Sebastian's mom, Marie Harris, was one of the instructors, and we would get together and we'd sort of help each other, you know, what should we do next, and how's your group going? And Marie said, well, we're all going to write a home poem, you know. Yeah. So yeah. There I was, my project, and I had to come up with a poem. So I decided I would write this poem, and I wanted to use words around building homes, words that I hadn't used yet, like beveled. I hadn't used the word beveled in a poem yet. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. So I asked my husband words for writing about building, because he's an engineer, not that he builds houses, but he knows a lot about tools. So he gave me a lot of words, and we talked, and I wrote it, and I made the mistake of reading him an early draft, and mm-hmm. which you shouldn't do. And it starts pretty much where it starts now. Here's the orchard. And Steve stopped me and said, wait. When you build a house, you start with the foundation. And I said, well, that's how an engineer builds a house, but right. a poet builds a house very differently. So here's the poem. It begins with a quote by Ilya Kaminsky, a wonderful Russian poet. I'll build you a house, and here's the quote. All I want is a human window in a house whose roof is my life. For Steve. Here's the orchard, here's the leaf. Here's the beveled slant of dusk. Here's the jamb to hang the door. Here's the flame that heats the stone. Here's the rasp that smoothed the pine. Here's the rusty path, the crumbs, the rot that silts the runnel's pull. Here's the window, here's the eye, the raven cast. Here's the granite, here's the latch. Here's the open book, the light. Here's the fruit, the bone, the seed. I'll raise the house that rides the earth. I'll gather plums. I'll plant my touch. So that was the poem.
Lovely, lovely. Yeah.
That I wrote for the Poet Laureate. Yeah.
Beveled slant of dusk. Ooh. Nice.
It has a kind of cathedral light, which other people have called it. But there is that edge to it when it comes down.
Right.
Especially through trees.
Right.
And we have trees, a lot of woods behind us. Yeah. So. Yeah. We have an orchard. I mean, this isn't my house, but it's the idea of how do you make a home? Mm-hmm. You know, when someone said, how did you come up with the last line, I'll plant my touch? Mm-hmm. And I said, I have no idea. It's that magical last line that somehow wants to be there. And your whole job in writing the poem is to pave the way for that to come.
Sure.
It's embedded in the first line, too, usually, but you don't know it.
Right, right. It's a process of discovery.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a process of seeing what it is you did.
Right.
Of having it knock you on the head and say, did you see that? And you go, oh, well, right. Thank you.
Oh.
And you know, it's true that if you're not paying attention, or if your intention is something else, which is sort of about the ego and not about the poem, you'll never find that.
Right, right.
It's really important, I'm saying this to myself, to let that go so it goes where it wants to go. Yet the impulse to write is almost physical, and you have to pay attention to that.
Right.
They're almost opposites. You know, the impulse is the urge, and then there's the letting go.
Yeah, yeah. The continual tension of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's do read another one.
Okay. I'm going to read this one for you. I know you lost your dog. What was your dog's name?
Lily.
Yeah. Lily.
Yeah, she was a great little beast.
Oh, beast.
Beast.
Beast. We do love. Yeah, well, we're fortunate those of us who have lived with animals, because I think animals teach us so much more about whatever it is that they bring. We've had five dogs in our lives together, and every dog has taught us something else.
Yeah.
And the dog in this particular poem is his name was Rusty, uh-huh. and he was a Buddhist, uh-huh. and he actually meditated. You would right. see him in the back seat of the car with his head against the side meditating. Uh-huh. Wasn't yeah. asleep, but yeah. he was meditating. And whenever another dog came that he didn't particularly like, or if another dog in the family, because our kids have dogs and we would all be together, he would just turn around. Uh-huh. He would just turn around, and he was gentle, but he knew what he wanted. So yeah. he taught us peace.
Yeah.
We respected that in
yeah.
him.
Yeah, he sounds way advanced.
He was very advanced. We of course had a course correction with the dog that followed him, because clearly Rusty was more evolved than we were.
Yeah, right. Which happens.
Oh, yes, yeah. yes. I mean, his lesson was not lost on us, nor did it save us meeting Max. And Max, unfortunately, didn't last very long. I think he got into something that poisoned him, and that's the poem I read at Malaprop's, right, Max's right. Eye, yeah. Which I hope will end up in a book. And I've often thought of giving a reading with just doing my dog poems, because
yeah.
even though I've written elegies, I do have dogs. A dog walking with me somewhere, it seems, all the time, since yeah. what I do is I walk to the harbor.
Right.
And in terms of, this is, I live near the harbor, so that'll help. You'll see some images that might show that. And the other thing is, I do mention this chair. And for years and years and years, I would drive by on the ocean road, and in the marsh across from the harbor, across from the ocean, was this leather recliner. And for years it got mushier and smaller, well, lower, and until finally it disappeared. And I always wanted to put it in a poem, so it makes an appearance in this poem. And of course, it's about putting our dog down. It's the first time we've had to put a dog down. They've all died differently. So this was my first lesson in killing a dog. Mm. Good dog die. One. Who dragged the chair through soggy grassland? Then waited on birds, as if their survival depended upon a scattering of cracked seeds. Whose body, with its back to the sun, watched the tide recede, wind climbing the mine's rickety staircase? It could have been either one of us, walking the marsh's mute audience of reeds. Two. One held the dog's head between his palms. The other whispered in his ear, "Good dog, die." The other's eyes shut against what she remembered of his face, the music of early snowfall on his hair. Mercy has little to do with death, very little. Nothing could be stranger. But then we dug the hole, chose the stone, before the needle stung his skin. Then someone tapped us awake. It was many years later. It was later the same day. Look, a boat is floating down the street. Nothing could have been stranger. Yet there it was. Dog, boat, the tide running out.
Nice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Sorry about Lily.
Yeah, she was a good friend.
I know.
Yeah.
They do love us.
They do. Yeah. What is the old bumper sticker you sometimes see? Lord, help me be half the person my dog thinks I am.
Well, my husband has one in his pickup that says, "Dog is my co-pilot."
Yeah.
We all feel that they are there to teach us. And yeah. Max, our dog that recently died, and we didn't have for very long. He was a rescue dog, most of our uh-huh. dogs, but the first pup wasn't. He was so difficult. He was just difficult, and we just had to work really hard with him and
yeah.
really love him. And unfortunately, then he checked out, but he taught us that you can love an animal and a person back into health.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I always wait for that lesson to dawn on me, so yeah. maybe Lily has a lesson.
I'm sure she does. Right.
For you.
Right. Yeah. I'm working on that now.
Let it. It'll show you what it is.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, let's hear some more.
Okay.
You've published not only The Last Island, but mm-hmm. Several chapbooks. And
yep. I have. I'll read you my earliest. Yeah,
let's dig back.
I think, you know, you said, what was your first publication?
Yeah.
Well, I had several publications, but my first major publication that I was very excited about was with Poetry Magazine.
Oh, wow.
And I don't remember when this was published, but the poem was at least 10 years old. I had sent it around because I liked it. And when they took it, I just said, you should never give up on a poem that you like. 10 years, the poem must have, I don't know how many places it went to.
Right.
And it's in the voice of my grandfather, and I probably wrote this when I was 25 to 30, somewhere in that time frame, and it didn't appear till several years later. And it's a story my grandfather told me about leaving Russia, and its title is Zadie's Short Career in the Russian Army. And Zadie means grandfather in Yiddish, for those of you who don't know that. And I will give myself a little leg up by saying it's probably the only funny poem I've ever written. I'm a very funny person, but I'm a deadly serious poet, which is very annoying.
Oh, wow.
For me, which is why I wrote stories for a while. So here's my poem, and it's Benjamin Kovitz is speaking this, so it's a persona poem.
Okay.
Zadie's Short Career in the Russian Army. I heard a noise like feet rustling. It was so dark you couldn't see the sky. I said, halt, or I'll shoot. It moved closer until I felt its steamy breath. I shot one, two, three times. The general's cow collapsed at my feet. Looking at it, I thought about America and what a wonderful place it would be to live. So he fled. That's his story. So I'm here and my family's here because my grandfather shot the cow, the general's cow. I thought he'd better skedaddle out of there.
Good shot.
Good shot. Well, it was a big target. cows are large, especially when they're right in front of you, as that one seemed to be.
And they don't move very quickly.
No, they don't. They have bovine moves, which are slow. Let's see.
But a fortunate shot, at least.
It was a fortunate shot, and then he got the heck out of there. Yeah. I think I'll read. I do like to write some sexual poems. They come up. And this one, The Moon is White, is in this chapbook, but it's also in the larger book,
okay.
The Last Island. And this takes place, the setting for this is our summer. We have a summer home on a lake in Norway, Maine, on an island.
Nice.
And one summer morning, my husband and I both got up, I don't know, 3 or 4 a.m. to go to the outhouse. Mm-hmm. And when we weren't wearing any clothes, and we went and sat on the dock, sort of naked.
Yeah.
Sort of, I guess. Sort of
naked.
Naked. There were no shoes.
Naked.
Even.
Naked.
Naked. For those who... North Carolinians, we are naked, and but the poem grows out of that experience. Although it's almost like an amalgam of life on an island, but in a sensual way. The moon is white. He wanted to undo something, her hair, close the cupboards. Cross the floorboards in light. He moved like the young men in her novel, late 19th century, their bodies, dry, calm leaves. Over the island, the sky was years away, not a cloud. She studied his palm, an open box, opalescent interior, pearls, blue flames. Ah, the thumbprint on her nipple. He balances the moon on his tongue. So that's,
nice.
Yeah, that's life, idyllic life.
Yeah.
On an island.
Yeah.
And it sounds often right. Is idyllic.
Right, right. Islands are like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Their own little worlds. Yeah.
Yeah. There's all that water and light.
Yeah.
And then there's the disconnect. I mean, we're very close to the mainland. It's a very narrow lake, and we are smack in the middle, so you can swim it. You can a quick, you know, motorboat ride.
Yeah.
But once you're there, you are away. We used to say we had no T's. We had no telephone, no toilet. What was the last one? Telephone, toilet. I don't know.
Television?
Television,
yeah,
right.
Television.
that thing. No, and we still don't have a television. We now have a composting toilet. Okay. But we use the outhouse. Yeah. And unfortunately, we have a cell phone, which Steve hates. But so it does connect us.
Right, right. You can turn them off, though.
Everything gets turned off. All the clocks have been unplugged.
Yeah.
There are some old clocks there, old kitchen clock and a clocks that don't work.
Yeah.
It's
sort of a graveyard for clocks.
It's a graveyard for clocks and old clothes. Uh-huh. A lot of old clothes go
wind up there. And, yeah.
I do a lot of writing there. Mm-hmm. I like to write by hand.
Yeah.
I don't bring a computer up there at all.
Do you just sit down with a piece of paper and a pen?
Yep.
Radical. Yeah, that's great.
Well, I'm old enough to own it. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I try to do yoga and then go down to the dock and sit there by myself and wait to see what's going to come. And I give it at least an hour. And so I'll always start by reading. I love Gerald Stern's poetry. Uh-huh. I find he's our contemporary Whitman. Uh-huh. His poems sing and they're exuberant and they include so much, and the movement is what I love.
Yeah.
He can move a poem in ways that are very surprising.
Yeah.
I can't write like that, but he can open me up.
Right.
So I have one of
his. He helps you write like yourself.
He helps me write. Oh, that's a good. Yeah, I bet you've used that line. That's a good line.
Anyway.
You just made that up?
I just made that up.
That's a good one.
Good.
It's yours.
I'll try to remember it.
Let me email me. I'll tell you. Okay. It was very good. That's a good. That's a great definition for a teacher. Yeah.
And you also teach.
Yes, yeah. I taught for years.
Speaking of teachers.
When I first started writing and I was taking classes with Charlie Simic, I was just what they call a special student. I was an adult ed, and I discovered that there was this program called Artists in the Schools, and it grew out of the first National Endowment for the Arts money that I think came with Kennedy, and every state established an arts council, and Marie Harris was instrumental in starting the Poets in the Schools in New Hampshire, and then it broadened to Artists in the Schools, and I discovered that they had this, and I could actually, if I qualified, I could get paid to go into schools and work with kids.
What a concept.
Well, I know it's dying out now, of course, you know, but I think our state, anyways, cut back dramatically. Mm-hmm. I was qualified. I applied. I became qualified as a visiting artist. I started that when I was in my 30s, and I did that for almost, 25 years.
Yeah.
In and out of schools all over New Hampshire, from little kids in kindergarten to high school, and then I broadened to work as a visiting artist in nursing homes and in the women's prison, and found the experience of bringing poetry to people that were actually just asking people to reveal in poetry what it is they needed to say was transforming. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, when I finished at UNH, I returned there a couple of years later. I covered for Simic when he was on leave, and then they sort of kept me there. And so I taught there for 7 or 8 years, and I taught at Lesley University and Northern Essex University. So I taught at university, but I see myself more as a teacher in any setting where someone wants to write a poem.
Uh-huh.
And the last group I worked with was called AIR, Arts in Reach, and it was a program that works with adolescent girls at risk.
Uh-huh.
And the whole model is to put adolescent girls in contact with mature and accomplished women artists.
Right.
So the last job I had was working with a wonderful photographer, Courtney Bent, from New Hampshire, and myself. We worked on poetry and photography with these young women, and I stopped last year when my astrologer said, "You're done."
Yeah.
And I said, "Thank you." I bought a bottle of wine that said, I think it was called Over the Hill. Over the Hill. I think it was. It was wonderful. It was my little celebration. And I still meet with one of the kids who was in the project, and she took a year off before going to college. And it was a great opportunity to be with girls who wanted to express themselves mm-hmm. and just needed some guidance. And that's really all they needed was a little bit, well, why don't you try this or listen to this poem? And then they would just burst out. So I feel fortunate to have been a teacher.
Yeah.
But we have a full life. We have kids, grandchildren. And my husband retired 8 years ago, and I started to look at him. He was having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would.
Good for him.
Bye, honey. Yeah. I'm going to work. I don't like this picture. And I thought it was good to quit while I was ahead, and I could. Mm-hmm. We were done with some of our financial obligations.
Yeah.
I think that there are many lives to live, and I must be into the next one.
Yeah, into the next phase.
Mm-hmm. Right. Whatever right. that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. Good. It seems to be a good one for you.
I think it's good.
Yeah.
I think I'm very, very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
Very fortunate.
Well, good. Excellent.
Thank you.
listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio today, New Hampshire poet Mimi White. So, Mimi, let's do here some more poems.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll read you a few from The Last Island, and then I'll read you a new one that I wrote while I was here.
Oh, that'd be great.
One of the things I was supposed to do while I was here.
You had a list of things?
Well, yeah. One was to write, which, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other one was to fly fish, because my husband and I both love to fly fish, and you can't do a lot of fishing in New Hampshire in March.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Maybe in May.
Yes, in May you can. And I love being on a river. And we didn't even know about the Davidson River in the Pisgah National Forest.
It's a great river.
It's a beautiful river. There are big fish in there, standing in the river, trying to coax a trout to the fly is very meditative.
Yeah, yeah.
And solitary, it reminds me a little bit of writing, sort of casting the line.
Right.
You know, laying the line out and then laying it out again and varying the length. Waiting for the line to unreel behind you before you uncork it so that it goes forward. So there's a lot of tension and release. So I've done more of that maybe than write, although I write pretty much a lot. Steve said, "Where's your writing?" I said, "Well, I do it when I can't sleep. So you don't know about it." I'd like to read two from the book and then one that I think is close to being done. Great. The one I'd like to read first is called Minus Zero, and it's for Robert Creeley.
Oh, yes.
Robert Creeley chose my chapbook, The Singed Horizon, as the 2000 winner of the Philbrick Poetry Award.
Yeah.
And it was a remarkable evening with him. We had supper with a lot of people from Brown University. He was teaching in Providence at that point. And then he read first, and I read second.
Oh,
and I don't know where this came from, but I didn't have an inch or a speck of fear.
Yeah.
I don't usually get fearful when I read, but it was pretty imposing.
Right.
Line up. You know, Robert Creeley and Mimi White. And it was a beautiful experience for me. And we corresponded thereafter until his death. And the morning I found out that he had died, I was working on this poem. And I re-looked at it and wrote it toward thinking of him, especially as it ends.
Yeah.
So this is for Robert Creeley, and the first three lines are from one of his journals, and I can't tell you which ones, and I can just tell you they're not my words, but they're his, and I've rearranged them.
Okay.
Minus zero. Nothing to touch except old paper and two people talking. Since it is spring, and red buds disguise what one might be thinking. Just the other day, harbor light took me elsewhere and to boats. Strange how the mind is supple and bones are singularly fixed in time. On our morning walks, my dog and I sniff for winter. Even the matted chill under old leaves nudges him along, deeper into the past, and I check the wind for a late March storm. Let's go backwards, he says, looking up at me, as if he knew that tides pull the deepest channels clean, and a dazzling moon will lull me further from you and you and you, whom I will forget in the frenzy of the garden's splendor. I am ripping dead vines. I am checking for damage. And if the bluebird decides against all odds to make my field her home, I will still weep. Next fall, next spring, even in the 0 hours of winter, you will be song. And, you know, when a poet dies whose work you love and who is such a fine human being, those words do become song and they become immortal. And I feel that way about Jane Kenyon, who is a wonderful New Hampshire poet, dying way too young in her 40s. And her words, I wish there were more. Yeah. But I'm grateful for the ones that are there.
Right, right.
And Creeley's work is like that.
Yeah.
It's a larger opus, but each one is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So And yeah. this the last one is the last poem in the book, and you'll notice there are birds, which is one reason why the cover of the book is dying grape leaves. We actually have a grape arbor in our yard, mm-hmm. and a nest with two eggs. I love the transitional time when things that were beautiful and ripe have turned toward decay. Because I think I'm born in November.
Yeah, the autumnal. Yes.
I love the autumnal term. Where people think you're dark, and I say, no, you have a handle on what it means to live and to die, which also means to live.
Sure.
And the birds fly in and out of my poems. I have a fondness for birds. Yeah. I'm not someone who keeps a list, but I do like to know what I'm looking at, and I love the song. And a friend of mine, Betsy Bischoff, this is for Betsy, releases birds that are injured and helps put them back into the world. She often brings birds to my house because we have a variety of terrain. We have an orchard, we have marsh, we have forest, and she wanted to release the cedar waxwings, an injured one that was healthy, into my yard. So she brought it, and we got talking. And she'd leave, and she said, oh, you'll have to do it in the morning, very, very early. Oh, you know, this is how you do it. And I'd never released a bird. Well, you have to put your hands on the bird. I mean, you have to do that. You have to launch it.
Yeah.
Yes, and you have to reach into the box, you know, that.
Uh-huh.
And at the same
scary.
Yes, all that doesn't sound scary, but I was nervous. Yeah. But I was happy and grateful to have the bird sleep in the house with me in his little box with the cover, because Steve had gone winter hiking, and I was thinking about him out there in the mountains and in the snow. And so this poem came from that. It's called My Friend Brings Me a Cedar Waxwing to Release into the Orchard. Inside the white box, the bird bats her body against the cardboard sides. This is how you still her. My friend cups her hands around imaginary softness, like this, she says, and lifts her closed palms. I do not know the name for this gesture. I do know its formal desire hinges on the music of the wrist. It is almost spring. We sit in that brief time when afternoon leans against the light. Rain turns to snow and back again. Thick black buds are shining. The bird's wings flap. I measure her fierceness against the room's silence. My sweetheart is hiking in snow. I think it is the only language he knows, white breath on the skin. I write love letters with my finger on the sky. Inside the white box, the bird dreams an eye, then a beak, then a wing. Word by word, she sets herself free.
Nice.
It seemed like the right one to end the book.
Yeah.
And of course, there are parallels for the writing that came up at the end. You know, word by word, she sets herself free. You know, the whole persona of the poet and the speaker of the poems. And that's when I realized that Baron Wormser, who helped me shape the book, had actually shaped a book.
Right, right.
And I'm very grateful for his efforts in doing that.
Yeah.
He revealed what I couldn't see.
That's a special talent, isn't it?
Yes.
It is.
It's good if you're a writer to find someone who knows how to do that and get friendly with them.
Right. Right.
Get their email.
Yeah.
And then I did have others, but I didn't bring them to the studio, but I did bring the journal that I'm keeping here, which mostly is bits and pieces of lines and waiting to see what will shape itself.
Mm-hmm.
But this poem is called After Words, and it grew out of going to the Arboretum.
Oh, yes.
And looking at the bonsai exhibit.
All right.
And spending
time.
Which is fabulous. It's fabulous. Yeah, and of course, a lot of it was missing because some are still in the winter greenhouses.
Right.
So, but I used that because I'm a fan of what's missing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to write more about what's present. That's my goal right now in my work is to write about what I have, what is there, not necessarily I have, but what is there, rather than what is missing.
Right.
But I do go between those tensions. So when some bonsai weren't there, I worked really well with the ones that were and took advantage of what wasn't.
Right.
So this is an attempt to write a poem that speaks to some of those ideas. Afterwards, in March, most of the bonsai are still in winter greenhouses. Empty stone shelves announce only the hardiest are on display. Forest meadow, shelter between islands, red maple in mountain wind. The sign asks us to become small, to listen to the tiniest leaf sprouting. Silence lifts, then settles on the mossy bed. When we walk the path without flowers or stones, light shines on every footfall.
That's nice already. Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's an attempt to bring the bonsai desire to make things small so that you can see into a poem and to see then what can be revealed from that. There were moments in looking at them when I felt drawn into the landscape, almost a psychedelic kind of experience where you're pulled into a universe that's where you're not standing.
Right.
And I'm pleased with what I have so far. I'll have to see if it sits. You have to let them sit.
You have to go back and
if you're embarrassed by what you discover when you go back, you know it's not right. Yeah, and if there are pieces that
are, or it's the wrong time for it or something. Yeah.
Well, the little quirks, the little scars, or the little problems will reveal themselves, then you just say, "Oh, look at that! That can't be there."
Right.
And you feel more brilliant than you did when you put it down. And of course you are.
Of course. Well, Mimi, thanks so much for coming in today. It's been great talking with you. And that is Wordplay for this week. Tune in again next Sunday for more poetry.
Thank you.